Hi, I'm Paul Listick, and welcome to Behind the Curtain. Well, hi, everybody. Welcome to this week's Behind the Curtain. I'm Paul Listick, and I love that music. It is from a great musical, and the guy that wrote that music would be surprised that it is so great today. We'll talk about that. But it is Disney's Newsies playing out at Paramount Theater in Aurora through October 20th. So thrilled to have lead cast members with me and also the director and artistic director for the Paramount Theater of Newsies. Welcome to all of you. And Jim Corti, I'm going to start with you. You know, I've interviewed Alan Menken on this show and in other places, and, wow. And I'm sure you know, that's why I'm starting with you. When Disney's Newsies first started out, man, it was a bomb, and Alan didn't quite know why. He was also shocked when it came back as big and cultish as it is. So talk a little bit about the plot of Newsies and why you think it is so great now, even though initially it wasn't.
Well, are you talking about the movie, the 92 movie?
Well, I think Alan was talking about the movie, but a lot of the music is the same and stuff, so that's part of the change. But sure, go ahead.
Oh, yeah, there's added music to the stage adaptation. But, the plot's incredible, and I'm it's about these young kids going up against these newspaper magnates and just getting a fair deal. They're doing all the work, and the big guys are making all the money, and they want to put an end to that, and they have every right to. And gosh, I can't get over the comparison to like Greta Thunberg right now. What's going on? What is she? 16?
Yeah.
Jack Kelly was 17, and it's just so it's almost a jolt seeing what's going on, and how that compares to the voices of kids. So indignant about the injustice.
And by the way, there is truth in this story, right? There's historical fact here.
Yeah, it actually happened, the Newsboy strike of 1899. There's so much you can read about it, so much photography, just heartbreaking, what these kids' lives were like, what they were suffering and putting up with just to survive and eke out a living.
Yeah, because sometimes I think you forget that the tragedy story, you think to myself, well, they weren't so bad. After all, they were singing Seize the Day back then, so I'm sure they were doing a great time. This triggers something in my mind I just have to tell you. So I was in Argentina once, and I was on the Casa Rosada where I did my own version of Don't Cry for Me, Argentina. And I said, you know, God, I'm in the same place that Evita sang that song. And someone looked at me and went, Paul, that's in the show. She didn't sing it. And I forget that sometimes. But let me say hi to Alex Pracken, who plays the lead in this show, Jack Kelly, although you're all leads in this show. But, you know, given what Jim just said, Alex, does it strike you? I mean, there is more recent news with some of these young people making a difference in society. But how do you view the role of Jack Kelly in the terms of you're seizing the day, you're leading these guys?
Yeah, you know, it's interesting. Jack, as we said, he's 17. He's more or less the leader of these boys, and he's as much of a older brother figure as a lot of these kids have. And he kind of sees it as his duty. He's got to look after these 13, 14, 15-year-old boys who have never had family, have lived on the streets their whole lives. So as an extension of that, when these prices go up and he knows these young boys, himself included, but also these young boys that he considers his family, they can't afford this. He's like, you know what? I gotta step up and protect them, because this isn't fair to them, and they're not going to be able to fight for themselves unless myself and all of us step up to Pulitzer and Hearst together. And it's really beautiful, because Jack, along the way, you know, he starts this strike on his own, but he doesn't have really any idea what he's doing. He might cover it up and make it look like he does, but he doesn't really. So along the way, you know, he gets the help of Davy and Catherine to to band together against Pulitzer, and it's this family of young people who have been pushed down, downtrodden. You know, Catherine has been in more what she would consider frivolous pieces until now, and she sees a way that she's impacting. Davies lives a little bit more sheltered life up until now, and it's these people from all different backgrounds coming together to fight against this common cause, all of which who are young, strong, resilient, intelligent people, and it's beautiful to see.
I think you make a great point, too, which is that Jack doesn't necessarily know what he's doing, but his guys think he does, so he has to, he's got to become the leader. Of course, all you really want to do is move out to Santa Fe, which is a beautiful song. But let me go to Corey, and Corey Tarhan, who plays Davy, and again, I'm using, I know people call you Corey sometimes, but Corey makes your parents happy if they're listening to this, so this is all about your family and keeping them happy. They'll probably call you, hey, Corey, I'm glad you corrected. Anyway, so Davy, and Alex kind of alluded to this, Davy is different. I mean, for one thing, in this show, what makes him different is he actually has a home to go to.
Right. Yeah, no, Davy's got a few things going for him. Yeah, he has a home, so he has somewhere to go back to. He has that sort of sense of security, and he's certainly not sleeping on the streets like other boys. But he's also educated, and he's somebody that I think is looking forward to continuing his education. He and his brother are forced to sort of find work because of, you know, his dad being injured and laid off from his job. But I think the intention the entire time is that Davy's just there to, initially at least, to support his family so that he can, you know, become educated and go and possibly support them even further and maybe have a family of his own one day. But certainly I think what he sees in Jack is, you know, this friend who is definitely a leader, who's definitely strong, who's definitely has the right idea, but maybe just can't do it alone. And Davy sort of has that systematic approach to things. And I think, ironically, kind of bringing it back to these modern times, I think it's sort of what we need right now is I think there's a lot of need in the world to do something, to get something done. But it's almost like we can't agree on a way of doing it. And I like to think that Davy sort of becomes that tool for the newsies.
And Justine Cameron, you play Catherine, and you know, again, and all of you thus far have been sort of tying this, what happened back in 1899, and you're all seeing its relevance today, and I agree with you. You could just look at so many different situations going on in this country today, much less the world, and you just see where these themes can resonate through. And for me, Catherine, talk about the role of the power of women, the role of women today. You know, I don't know whether or not this character in real life was who she was back in 1899. Maybe you do, but or maybe Jim can shed light. But talk about the importance of Catherine in this show, because this is the year of the woman when you look at that role.
Yeah, totally. I think that Catherine is like an incredibly important character because, well, we all know that Newsies is a little bit man-heavy. And I think that she comes in with this idea that she can make the world better through journalism, and she sees the power in that. And like Alex said, she's been given only like some opportunities because people look down on her for being a woman who's trying to write about the news, and have only really given her very frivolous pieces to write about. And then she sees this story of these young children trying to make a change for the better and thinks that she would be able to help them. And I think that she also sees that, like, it would be able to help her for really taking a stand and like, being able to write about the story she wants to write about. And I think that, I don't know, I think I see a lot of myself and Catherine and a lot of many strong women that I know that are out there fighting for social change now because, I don't know, it's not always just about... it's not always just about like but she's fighting for other people as well as herself. And I think that she really comes in and is able to help them. And at first they don't always really listen to her, but then they're able to come together and tell their story for the better.
Well, yeah, because
so I feel really happy to be able to be a female telling the story, and I think that it's really awesome.
Yeah. I mean, that's the timing. I think it's sort of a sea change. Today, a woman in power, a woman of power, we just sort of like, well, yeah, of course. But back then, I imagine it was taking everybody off guard, and even, let's be honest, Alex, Jack Kelly was sort of interested in the romantic piece of this, not necessarily in Catherine's power grab. So we see that relationship develop. Jim, I got to say, this was my first time out of Paramount, and I shouldn't admit that because I should have been going there for for years, but as a city boy, I went, it is time to venture out to the world of Aurora. And I got to tell you, you make that trip once, and now I see where I almost have to see everything at Paramount, because the theater is amazing. It's incredible. There is parking on the street. There's every reason to go out there. And just maybe let me have you give a shout out, Jim, to just the notion of what putting a production on in Aurora and at the Paramount is like, because it's as big and as bold as any Broadway musical downtown.
Well, yeah, we have kicked off our ninth season. We've been at this now for nine seasons and learning how to work together. And really, it's been all about collaboration from the box office to the valet out front to costume building, set building, props construction.
Drinks that are cheaper than downtown.
Well, that, yeah. But in terms of the product right. that people are getting, it's a result of this working together and everyone having their eye on the target, that we're all heading for the same goal and to do something excellent. And it really makes a difference when everyone works together like that. And I think that's what people are finding, what the premium is, what the value is to coming to Aurora and getting a good bang for your buck, frankly.
Yeah, you got, I mean, the orchestra sound, the lighting, just an amazing experience. And I know you've got a very strong subscriber base. Aren't you like the second largest subscriber base in the country? Something like that.
That is true. That is true. Yeah, and that's pretty quick growth. That's a lot of people growing with us very, very quickly. And
I think that's because they knew Korai was going to be in a show and they wanted to make sure they subscribed immediately.
right.
Alex, I have a listener sent in a question knowing I was going to do this. And so let me pose it to you. And he and I went back and forth a little bit. His name is Raphael. And we got into a little debate about this concept of Santa Fe, because the show opens with the notion of Jack Kelly having this dream of going off to Santa Fe. And in the end, Raphael's point was, you know, Jack, this is not a happy ending for Jack. He's not going off to Santa Fe. My answer was, no, I think Santa Fe is not about Santa Fe. It's what it represented. It was symbolic. And Jack does. This is a happy ending. Jack does get his dream. So you decide. Don't worry about the fact that I'm the host. You decide which of us is correct in terms of Jack Kelly's dreams, Alex.
That's a lot of pressure.
Yeah, I know.
Yeah, right. I think it's a combination of both. You know, the show does start with this notion of Santa Fe, which in my Jack's world is kind of this, Jack has some faint memories of his parents and it was a kind of lullaby that they used to sing to him. So he has this melody in his head, and Santa Fe for him represents, it's an escape from what his life is now, which is barely surviving, which is scrounging for food every day, sleeping on the streets, and him thinking there's got to be a better way, a better place that I can live. And, you know, ultimately, no, he decides not to leave because he's found something that is maybe even better. It's this renewed trust, this renewed love in this family, this brotherhood that he's always had, but seeing how deep it runs, how they would follow and support each other until death's door. You know, these kids get the crap beat out of them and they still fight for each other. And, you know, he has new friends and Davey and Crutchy and, you know, a new love interest in Catherine. So, and he's made life better for himself through the strike and all of his brothers. And, you know, he also says at the end of the day, now my eyes is finally open and my dream stays the average size. And I think he realizes that, you know, life in Santa Fe might be different. It might be better, but he's also got his family right here. And what else does he need in the end?
That was very diplomatic. You just said both of us are right. That was pretty good.
I'm trying to make both of you happy.
All right. And Korai, you know, when I think back, just I've seen you as Pippin in Pippin. You were in Memphis. Some great roles and really showcasing your voice. And here, talk to me about the power of, because you're also part of that ensemble group. I mean, you know, you've got some amazing dancers in this cast and whatever. But Korai, talk to me about the powerful and the importance of the ensemble in this show. I know Jim probably wants to shout out about that,
absolutely,
too. But
absolutely.
Yeah. Oh, yeah. Absolutely. I mean, I God only knows what Jim was doing, throwing me in these in the midst of this talented bunch of dancers. I don't know. I try to hold my own in King of New York, but that's about all I can say.
Well, sometimes he puts you in the back, so that's what he was thinking. But go ahead.
He does. Yeah. No, he does. but no, it's just an incredible group. And you know, when people think of New Jeans, they think of the high flying tricks and they think of the dancing, but. But what I realized through the process of this is that the most powerful part of the Newsies are, well, is their singular voice. And I think anybody that's seen this show can attest to just how powerful it feels, both on stage and off. When you hear, you know, the vocals come through and Seize the Day or World Will Know or any of these big numbers, it's just that singular voice that resonates through that theater. And it's so damn powerful. And it sounds corny, but you can feel that the power of change starts with something like that, something that can kind of move the earth. And I just think the power of our ensemble really just brings that integrity to the words that were written in the score. And I can't speak highly enough about some of the guys we have in this ensemble who are just so different too. I mean, really nobody in this cast is the same. Everyone's got a different skill set. Everyone brings something different to the table. And it's such a blast working with them.
Justine, kind of a challenge for you and Catherine playing Catherine Plummer, because this, if I'm right, this is not only your debut at Paramount, which I know is true for others in the cast like Alex, but it's also your professional debut. That means Jim Corti put a lot of trust in you to take on such a major role.
Yeah, it is my professional debut, and Jim has been wonderful through this whole process.
See that, Jim?
Well, I would have been crazy not to cast you. Come on.
So, Jim, there's so much that goes on in the Paramount, and I love getting the both by emails and also the list. I mean, the Paramount itself, everything, you've got Terry Fader coming in and Frank Caliendo. I mean, it's almost as though 42nd Street down the line, I think, is no, that's not what I'm looking at. I'm sorry, producers for the best. But it's just it's hard to pinpoint. If somebody says, what does Paramount put on? You got to say, you got to look at the schedule because it's a little of everything.
Well, yeah. And you know, just to
Kinky
be clear.
Kinky Boots, by the way, too, coming up.
What was that?
And I want to mention Kinky Boots coming up, too. Can't wait for that.
Yeah. Yeah. What a great show. But the thing is, this is just so you know, I'm only involved with the Broadway series, you know, the four shows a year. Mm-hmm. And that's a full show. But as far as these other acts that come to the Paramount, there is a whole nother group of people working on that and doing it brilliantly. And, we just go at it side by side and fill that theater with as much entertainment as we can find and at a very excellent level.
No, go ahead. Well, I was going to say, it's just, you know, here I am. I focused a little bit on this interview about the Paramount because I was just so impressed with my experience there and just, you know, the quality of the production and what's going on that I felt like I really needed to do the theater itself a shout out, even beyond the Broadway series, the other things that go on there, because it's a great little neighborhood. Dinner at Gillerson's ahead of time. Just a great little neighborhood to just come to.
Oh, my gosh. Well, it's just blossoming. There are going to be at least three big restaurants opening next month. This fall is going to be, it's going to be jumping around here.
Well, I got some.
It's a very exciting time.
I got some free pretzels when I went into Gillerson. So Alex and Corey and Justine, maybe throw my name around when you get in there. You might get something. I can't be sure. Before
Let's
the show.
Try it out.
But Newsies is playing at the Paramount Theater through October 20th. That is the right date, Jim, right? That's not going to change.
October 20th.
Yep. Okay, and ParamountAurora.com is where you can get tickets. It really is a must-see, and I think if you're like me, if you've never been to the Paramount Theater, you're going to fall in love with it, as I did, and want to go back for pretty much everything, certainly everything Broadway that goes on at that theater is just amazing. I want to thank you guys, Jim, Alex, Corey, Justine, for being with me. Break legs every night through October 20th as you do the show. We're going to go out playing one of my favorite songs, the song that I can never get out of my head whenever I see Newsies, and it's The King of New York. Thank you, guys. Well, let's turn a little bit from music over to the world of drama, although a drama with some funny moments, I must say. And that is the show Oslo, which is playing at the Broadway Playhouse through October 20th. A performance from Broadway in Chicago, but also from Timeline Theater. Joining me to talk about it is the artistic director of Timeline Theater, PJ Powers, and one of the leads of Oslo, Scott Parkinson, who plays Terj Larsen in the show Oslo. Gentlemen, welcome to both of you. I appreciate your time.
Thank you. Happy to be here.
And yeah, the show is totally amazing. I had not seen it before. It was on Broadway. It came here from Broadway, but I had not seen it on Broadway. And it just kind of blows you away. You never look at your watch. You're tied to it the whole time. Mm-hmm. But that's typical of any Timeline theater company performance. PJ, I want to start with you because you are the artistic director of Timeline. And if I start listing all the awards, Jeff Awards and such that Timeline performances have gotten, we won't have time for the interview. So it's just been on, but it's been around since 1997. But there is something special for Timeline to put something on. It's about a moment in history. Can you talk to me about what Timeline's all about?
Yeah, thanks so much. And yes, I was one of the founders of the company back in 97. And for all of our 23 seasons, our mission has been focused on exploring history. And really, it's about making connections between the past and present. And we use history really as a lens through which we dig into social and political issues in the here and now. And so Oslo is a perfect example of that. You know, it digs back into what led to the Oslo Accords in 1993, but so many of the issues in the play, you could close your eyes and think that you're, you know, hearing arguments about 2019. And that's really what the heart of Timeline's mission is about, is looking to the past to better understand how we got to where we are today and to hopefully better understand how we move forward.
And by the way, this show is being presented in conjunction with Broadway in Chicago. Broadway in Chicago. That's a first, right?
Yes, it is. We had a play called To Master the Art about Julia and Paul Child that we did a number of years ago, probably about 8 years ago, that we started at Timeline's home on Wellington Avenue. And that show got picked up and actually moved down to the Broadway Playhouse. This with Oslo, it's a bit of a different scenario. We, from the outset, reached out to Broadway in Chicago about us creating and mounting this show at the Broadway Playhouse. So it is all Timeline artists. Timeline is the producer and really the creator of the production. But we knew that we wanted it to be on a larger canvas than our current home.
And yeah, the current home for now, a new building is coming. We'll talk about that before we're done, but is a very intimate theater on Wellington that I'm going to miss, to be honest with you, because I walk there. And I think a lot of people say that, right? That can walk, don't move. But because you're right in the heart of a neighborhood and it's a very intimate space. The Broadway Playhouse, though, I'll give you kudos because, yes, it's a much bigger space, but it still plays as an intimate production. Let me go to Scott Parkinson, who's one of the leads. Scott, you're well known in Chicago. I mean, I've seen you at Writers Theater and Shakespeare and Goodman and the Court Theater, Northlight. You've done so many things. I know you played Hamlet. I don't think you've ever seen my Hamlet in high school, but I think you might want to, you know, just I can give you a few tips.
YouTube it.
So, is there a VCR tape somewhere?
No, I belong in Fiddler. I shouldn't do anything else. But anyway, so Scott, let me have you. Oh, wait, I had one other thing to say. So one of the things that I love about Timeline is that one of the ways you learn the history is when you walk through the hallways at Timeline, you're given the history all throughout these wonderful just storyboards and all this kind of stuff. And I thought, well, at Broadway Playhouse, we're going to lose that. Well, we not only didn't lose that, but now every playbill also has all that stuff that would probably be on the walls at Timeline. It's in our program. So it was important, obviously, PJ, to you two to do that. No need to comment. We'll just agree. Let me go to Scott and say, Scott, so for folks who don't know the story of Oslo, it's a true story. What's it all about?
Yeah. It's about Tarja Rode Larsen and his wife, Mona Yule,
who are Norwegians. They he ran at the time of the play's events. He ran an organization. He was a sociologist, and he ran an organization that did a lot of research into sociological conditions around the world. And she was a diplomat in the Norwegian Foreign Service, and they were living in Jerusalem and Tel Aviv, and they were visiting Gaza and the West Bank, and their experiences there led them to try and make some kind of a difference, to use their it's related in the play at one point. They have an experience watching these two boys, an Israeli soldier and a young Palestinian boy, and they see them sort of squaring off at each other, and they read this thing in their faces that moves them very profoundly and makes them want to make some kind of a difference in this conflict. So they use all their resources that they have at their disposal to try and get a back channel negotiation going on, because there's actually already a negotiation going on in Washington, which is not really working. It has a more pragmatic approach. And Tarja comes from a different approach. He believes that negotiation should be more one-on-one. It should be more focused on single issues as opposed to trying to take on all the problems at once. He believes it just should be more person-to-person, where you're connecting on an individual, personal level about family, about where you use humor. And he was kind of a pioneer in this approach, and he wanted to use this approach with the Palestinian-Israeli situation. So that's sort of where the play begins, and they do use those contacts to get in touch with some people from both sides, and they start to set up these meetings in Norway.
And, of course, what's so critical, we have to do a shout-out to the role of Mona Jewel, yes, a Norwegian diplomat played by the wonderful Bree Sudia. She was actually supposed to join us today and had a conflict at the last minute, so that's why she's not with us. But this little this husband-wife team, and what's amazing is it's real. I mean, it really, this was true.
Yeah, they're a real couple. They're still together today, And JT, the playwright, has spent a lot of time with both of them in crafting this play, and has sort of caught a wonderful sort of dynamic of their relationship. What I assume is their real relationship in life. I've never personally met them, but has tried to capture the spirit of that in this play, the kind of complementary forces between them that make them such a great team.
Do you know, and by the way, do you know whether, did they ever see it on Broadway, to your knowledge? Did any of these players?
They did,
Although
JT sort of famously didn't want them to know anything about the play until they saw it. So I think I saw that somewhere, that he kind of kept them out of the whole process of writing it and seeing it in any early form until it was actually done.
And how much, Scott, I'll stick with you. I know you guys just recently posted a picture. JT was in the audience watching the show. I'm just curious, was that a first time? Had you met him before, or was there pressure on you the night knowing he was there?
Well, there's definitely always pressure when the playwright's there. You want to do a good job, and you don't want to mess up any of his words, which, of course, I did. But I had only met him once before, actually. Years ago, I auditioned for his play, Blood and Gifts, a production of it at the La Jolla Playhouse, and he was in the audition. And I had a lovely time in the audition and a lovely time meeting him, and he was a terrific guy to audition with. But that was the only time I had met him before this past Saturday.
Did you get that role?
I did not, but I got close. I think it was down to me and maybe one or two other guys. So I did get a call back, and so it went well. I just unfortunately didn't get to do it. I would have loved to, because it's a terrific play.
I didn't know the answer to that question. I was hoping to give you a happy moment, and I just blew that. I'm sorry about that.
No, that's all right.
So PJ, what's really interesting too about the story here is that, you know, the critical players, Yitzhak Rabin, Yasser Arafat, we never see them.
Yeah, it's true. And I think in some ways, JT as a dramatist really wants to put some of the lesser known unsung heroes on stage. And really getting back to what Scott was referring to, that JT, you know, met and spoke with Tarja and Mona, the real life Tarja and Mona beforehand, but then wanted to be able to go off and write his own play and create characters that really fit the stage. And so I think maybe by keeping out of the play some of the most famous, notable people, like two that you mentioned, it allows him as a playwright to
to, you know, create characters using research. Definitely. I mean, JT did extensive research, but then, you know, he recognizes that at some point he has to put that research away and honor the theater.
And, you know, and PJ, when I I'm old enough to remember these events when they happen. And so true to timeline fashion, at the end of the show, we see the video. I don't think I'm saying anything that ruins anything, but we see video of Bill Clinton and Rabin and Yasser Arafat on the White House lawn. It sort of took on a whole different meaning watching it play out now, as then the cast informs us of what did happen to all of these people involved. And but that's important, I think, right, PJ, for timeline, to close the circle and let us know what's happened.
Yeah, it is, and I appreciate you giving a shout out to some of the complimentary materials we have for the play, both in the lobby down at the Broadway Playhouse and also our Backstory magazine. That's such a big part of what Timeline does, and it's what we've done here in our home on Wellington for over 20 years, and we didn't want to lose that down there. And but in many ways, JT was two steps ahead of us, and he ends his play sort of bringing the audience up to date, if you will. And I mean, it's part of why when I first saw this play in New York and was having dinner with JT afterwards, he said, this play is like a love letter to Timeline's mission. Tell me you want to do it. And I couldn't have agreed more. There's a great synergy between the stuff that he writes and the stuff that we do. And the play that Scott was mentioning a few minutes ago, Blood and Gifts, which was done at Lincoln Center. Timeline ended up producing right after Lincoln Center did it in 2013.
Scott, did you notice how PJ just name dropped JT in there, that he had dinner with him?
Yes, indeed. Yes, yeah. He's had dinner with him.
You know, when I was sitting around with Laurel and Hardy one day, I said, you know, guys, I'm kidding. And Scott, this may be a question you can't answer. Maybe PJ will have to. It's really a question for JT. But this was just something that struck me, so I get to ask you, which was at the end of the show, we learned that Rabin was assassinated by Israeli extremists. And then we're told that Arafat died years later. But the truth, as I remember it, was he was poisoned. That's not part of what we're told. And Scott, do you happen to know why that is?
You know, I don't know. I don't know if it was ever conclusively.
I don't think it was conclusive, but it was never conclusive.
So that may be why. That may be why JT doesn't touch that particular minefield. But I think it was just something that was alleged more than it was actually proved. So in the play, he simply says that he died in a hospital.
So PJ, that didn't come up over dinner.
No, it didn't. My hunch is that as Scott imagines, that JT just wanted to avoid the 10,000 emails and online line posts, taking him to task from a more journalistic perspective of what was proven.
Well, you're right about that. Having been on the air for a couple of days now talking about whistleblowers, I can tell you about the emails that come in on a nonstop basis from all those lovely viewers who are appreciative of what you have to say.
Or not.
And Scott, the humor, I said up front that the show is dramatic, but I kind of did toss in, but there is humor. There is humor in here, and it's almost as though this play really embraces those moments of humor. Jed Fader gets one. I think I've called him Fader on my show, and I think it's Fader. But he gets a great moment in terms of dressing up. I don't know that any of that was real, but it really offers the audience some light moments.
Yeah, which I think you need in a play like this. I mean, I think when most people hear that it's a play about the Palestinian-Israeli conflict, they think, oh my God, I want to open a vein. That sounds just terrible. But
is it a musical?
And especially if it's almost 3 hours, you think it's going to be talky, it's going to be dark, it's going to be depressing, and the play's not at all. I mean, of course, it brings in all the things about the conflict that are distressing, but it also keeps things moving very quickly. It keeps things very light with very humorous characters and situations. It works almost like a thriller in many ways, like a spy beach read sometimes when it's with more depth, obviously, than that. But it really keeps you engaged from beginning to end with humor, with with twists and turns, with surprises. And Jed's character is, I will say, that is the one sort of thing that I think JT took probably the most license in the play, is in the invention of that character. The real Uri Sevier was not quite as depicted in the play. But I think the play is all the better for introducing that element at that point in the play, to have somebody like that suddenly come on stage and bring a whole new energy and a whole new, it's just very important. So
it is, and a bit of humor to that role. Well, of course, and he was in Aladdin, so Jed has a great background for stepping into a role that offers that bit of humor. And Scott, I'll also ask you as we look at the things play out, do you ever have moments? I mean, this is 3 hours and it's a long play. Mm-hmm. Although I said I never look at my watch. I always figure when actors do musicals, they can always say, "Oh, good, we're going to get to do that song again." Do you ever sort of say, "Oh my God, I've got another 2 hours to go in this thing," or another episode? Because you really it doesn't read that way in the audience. But I was just curious inside acting.
No, I mean, sometimes the first, because we, in our production, so the play as written is three acts, and in our production we've combined what is JT's first act and his second act together before we actually take an intermission. So the first act is about an hour and a half long. So there are some times when, like right before we're about to go on, I think, oh, this is going to be a little daunting. But once you get on the train, it's so fast moving that you can't, there's no time really to like stop and think about, oh boy, this is, there's no time to stop. It just goes and goes and goes and goes. And that's what's fun about doing it and what's exciting about doing it. And then suddenly it's over and you're like, wow, we did that. And that was 3 hours and didn't feel like it at all.
I agree with you. Yeah, it goes so fast. It was such a joy. PJ, just for as long as I've got you here, talk a little bit about what else is going to come up as we move from the Broadway Playhouse over to back to Timeline, but just a couple of things that are on board for the rest of this season.
In a couple weeks, we're starting rehearsals for a great play called Rutherford and Son, which was written early in the 20th century by a woman named Geetha Sowerby, and then it was locked away for almost 80 or 90 years, or reportedly, because of the outrage that a woman had written such a progressive play in 1914, and the National Theatre of London resurrected it, and it's really now known as a great lost classic of the 20th century. So that is up next, and then two new plays, a fantastic play called Kill Move Paradise, really explores the notion of Black Lives Matter. And then rounding out the season is a world premiere by Chicago's own Tyler Abercrombie, an amazing play called Relentless that takes place in Philadelphia in 1918 and is about two sisters there and the legacy of their mother's past.
And, I mean, as a theater that has put up such great shows like Masterclass, The Audience, I mean, you've just done such amazing things over there. Those are just some recent things just popped into my head. And I was disappointed to hear you did not say that Fiddler on the Roof is coming up, because I thought I could do Tevye to Scott's Fiedka. I think Scott would
be. It's going to be an off night.
It's going to be a mean Fiedka from him, I think. But anyway, the Oslo is playing at the Broadway Playhouse. It's through October 20th. Tickets at BroadwayInChicago.com. And the great part of it is, even when that show has to leave the stage, Timeline isn't leaving. If you like what you see, and you will, you'll end up wanting to spend more time in the Timeline Theater, seeing all the shows that they put up, because PJ Powers is controlling everything over there. So it's always good stuff. PJ Powers, always good talking to you. You're great fun, my friend.
Always a pleasure.
And Scott Parkinson, I'm sorry for subjecting you to myself, but
no worries. It's been a pleasure. Thank you, Paul.
Absolutely. The show is Oslo Broadway Playhouse through October 20th, BroadwayInChicago.com. Don't miss it. And thanks for listening to Behind the Curtain. Thank you, gentlemen.
Thank you.
Well, if you want to know more about what we've talked about here, follow me on Twitter, Facebook, Instagram, at Paul Lisnek. That's PaulLisnek. And I'd love to hear your comments or topic suggestions for future podcasts. You can also go to my website, paullisnek.tv. And hey, don't forget to hit subscribe on WGN Plus and iTunes. And tune in each week to hear more insider scoop coming to you from Behind the Curtain.